Who of you needs an overview on the lecture? So, would you like to summarize the previous lecture? Because we're now starting a new chapter. And should we do a summary of the previous lecture? Or do you say, okay, I got everything in focus?
Rather not.
Rather not? Rather yes. Yeah, should we do a summary of the lecture, what we've heard so far? We can vote.
Yes, yes.
We can vote. How about a vote? Some new tool that we could explore in this lecture, a vote. So who wants to summarize the lecture so far? Okay, who would rather skip a summary? Okay. Why do we want to skip the summary?
Maybe we have next week another summary.
Or maybe we have next week. Who wants to do the summary next week? That's a pretty clear vote. Okay, so today we're starting a new chapter. So, because so far, okay, then let's do the summary. So far, we did everything we have discussed so far was, of course, interventional medical image processing. And what we heard so far were a couple of refreshers, right? So we were talking about a couple of tools. Who remembers one of these tools? Yes, you voted against the summary, so you must know everything, right? SVD. See, SVD, that's the answer. Okay, so SVD. Good. What's that good for, SVD? Full linear equations. So can you give an example? Yes. So, what's a famous example for a linear equation? Yes, awesome. Ax equals, so this is a vector, equals to b. And then exactly what you said, we solve it with the pseudo-inverse. And how do we do that? Well, yes. Ah, yeah, you take the SVD. Okay. So you multiply from the left side with the pseudo-inverse. And then you get a pseudo-inverse here times the vector b, and there you go, you have solved for x. Of course, we need to say that x is the unknown, yeah? So this, if b is the unknown, this is pretty trivial. Okay, so what happens if you have something like this? So this is a vector of zeros. What do you do then? Can you solve this with the pseudo-inverse? What happens if you do the pseudo-inverse?
You get zero?
Yeah, you get a vector of zero. So this is a trivial solution of this case, right? But you want to have the essentially the null space of matrix A. Yes? Yeah, exactly. So you can find your null space if you do SVD. It's part of the V matrix. Yeah, exactly. Good. What else can we solve with SVD? We can do this, we can do this. Let's say this will be maybe important today. Let's say you know by theory your matrix is supposed to be, so you're looking for a matrix, right? And then you compute some parameters and it's a 3x3 matrix and there's some noise in your data, then you probably get a matrix with rank 3. But you know by theory there's some projection in there, so you're projecting to a limited, to restricted space, and it should be rank deficient, so it should be a rank 2 matrix. So how can you do that with SVD?
Well,
yes?
You get the singular values, and you can pick like the most important ones, you order them, and take them.
Yeah, they should already be ordered, so you remember that you decompose A into U sigma and V transpose, and then you know that the number of singular values in sigma needs to be the number of rank, and then you just discard, let's say you have 3 singular values in there and one is pretty low, and you have 2 high ranks because they should be ordered by size, and then you just remove the least the singular value with the lowest entry, and then you can enforce that this matrix really has rank 2. So you can just make your matrix rank 2. Yeah? Exactly. So these are the kind of problems that you can solve with SVD, and it's super useful, and we use it every day. So, okay, good. What else did we talk about? SVD? Yeah, projection models. So what are projection models good for? And we used a trick, do you remember? We had this evil perspective projection, and it was nonlinear because we have to divide by the z component. Yeah, and then we did this nice trick. Yeah, you add a dimension and then you're in a homogeneous space and suddenly everything is equivalent up to scaling. And in this space you can express also a perspective projection just as a matrix multiplication. Exactly, so these were the projection models. So you remember that we had then, let's say we had, so in 3D you have X, Y, and Z, and then you add one component here. And then you can multiply this with some kind of matrix and project it into a U, V, W space. And then you divide by W and you're back in 2D. Yeah? And you can fill this matrix. So who knows what numbers I need to put in if I want to build an orthographic projection? So what? One. And then 0, 0, 0, and? 0, 1, 0, 0, and then? 0, 0, and now? 0, 1, or 1, 0? 0, 1. Yeah, so you select this guy at 0, 1. So you will get x, y, and 1. And this will be an orthographic, so not a perspective. And if you switch the two, you end up with something that is perspective. And you can do focal length and so on. But this is the main idea of your projection models. Okay, so then we went ahead. What did we do next? Yeah, so first of all, the new chapter was pre-processing. Good, and in pre-processing we started more or less with an example. Yeah? So this is just to introduce the topic pre-processing and what kinds of tricks you can apply to simplify a model if you can't compute it. So there was this is the scatter correction, yeah, but this was more or less an example. Yeah? So we don't repeat this too much. Yeah? Okay? You get the idea of why I'm saying this. Yeah, in the evaluation, there is a point where you have to answer the contents of the oral examination are clear to me, yes or no. Yeah? Okay? Good. Good. Next point. So what did we do next? We found out that if we want to find features in an image, what could be interesting?
Edges.
First came the edges. How do you detect an edge? I see the edges, I don't have to detect them. It's obvious. No. Yes. So you do filters, and edges have strong gradients. Yeah? So you use gradient images or gradient magnitude in order to figure out where edges are. And then we learned this very interesting tensor, the structure tensor. And with the structure tensor, we can differentiate between flat areas, corners, and edges in an image. And do you remember what you put into your structure tensor? Yes?
Multiplications of the gradient?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So this is essentially the gradient times the gradient transpose, which gives you the structure tensor. So if you the structure tensor you can get by taking your gradient, and so this is the gradient, and you multiply with the gradient transpose, then you get a matrix. And if you do that, what rank does this matrix have? Yes? One, exactly. So what do we need to do in order to still be able to have a full rank? So smoothing, yeah. You need some relaxation. You need some spatial averaging over some area that you still get the local context. And then depending on how much you smooth, the more you will be detecting local or more global structures. So if you apply a lot of smoothing there, you will be looking for larger structures. And if you apply less smoothing, it's more local. This brought us to a different technique, which was pretty similar. Yes, Wesselness. So what is Wesselness about? By the way, I just heard that Alejandro Frangi, he has his eighth child coming up. So he's not just known for Wesselness, he also has eight children. Yeah. And they're equally distributed. So it's four boys and four girls. Okay, so what's Wesselness? Yes? Yes. Yes. So you build some measure Wesselness, and this is probably a location X. And then, what's the other component in the Wesselness? So the important. So there's a couple of tricks that Wesselness is using. One is that you introduce a scale, and the scale is the degree of spatial smoothing. And then you build the Hessian matrix in this scale, and you look at the eigenvalues, and then you had this Wesselness measure, and you had these quanta RB. RB was the blobness, and then the structuredness. S is the structuredness, and RB is the blobness. So how do I need to define RB such that it becomes high when it is a blob? What's a blob? So let's stay in 2D. So we have this Hessian matrix. And this Hessian matrix, we do eigenvalue analysis. And then we get two eigenvalues. And then essentially, we have three cases. So what case do we have if we have two zero eigenvalues? Yeah, this is more or less flat, or yeah, no curvature. And if we have one high eigenvalue, yes? Yeah, so you this is essentially the vessel. You have high curvature in the one direction and it no curvature in the other direction, so you have some vessel-like structure. And if you have two high eigenvalues? No. That's the blob, exactly. That's the blob. So now we want to define some blobness. So how does the blobness look like? So if we compute it, I can hint you. Blobness was using a kind of fraction. And now it should be high if you have a blob, and it should be low if you have something else than a blob. So where do I put yes? The product of the eigenvalue is divided by the sum. No, I think you are in a different you are in the Harris corner detector now. Right? So yes? Yeah, it's the ratio. And which one do I put where? So the bigger one on the upper side, then I divide by something. So let's say it's a vessel if you take the bigger one to the top, and then do divide by something small, so it will be really big. So you need, so we need, let's say lambda 2 is the smaller one by lambda 1. Yeah. Okay, so this is our blobness. And the structuredness, this is more or less the amount of structure that's there. And this is just eigenvalue 1 to the power of 2, eigenvalue 2 to the power of 2, and the square root. This is the structuredness. And if you have those, these are, of course, for every scale. And then you can build a measure for Wesselness. And you say if both eigenvalues are low, it's 0. Huh? If they are below a certain, so it's actually something where you would have to split. But let's just think about the idea how to build this measure. And the idea was that we have more or less Gaussians. And a Gaussian is something e to the power of minus. And then you have, so it's a zero mean. Then you, so you have something here divided over 2. And then there is some kind of standard deviation, some kind of sigma or some parameter. I don't remember how the parameter is called. But just let's just say it's sigma RB or something. So I don't care how this parameter is called, but it has the function of a standard deviation. So what do we put in here? So this will have a high value when this value is Gaussian. How does the Gaussian look like? Where's the maximum? At 0. So if this is low, this will be high. And we want, which one will be low if we have a Wessel? The blobness should be low. Yeah? So we put in something like the absolute value of the blobness, or a blobness, no, it's blobness squared, right? So it's blobness squared, and then think, yeah. Okay, and then we multiply this, and this other, this value should be high, yeah? And here we take 1 minus e to the power of minus, and then again 2 and some standard deviation here. And this is then probably s. And here, of course, goes something like s squared. Then we are constructing essentially a Gaussian and 1 minus a Gaussian, because this guy is supposed to be, so the structuredness should be high, so we take 1 minus a Gaussian. So we just invert it. And then we multiply the two, and then we have something like a probability at every point in our Wesselness map. And then we fuse them together into a single Wesselness map by assigning the maximum over S over all of our. Okay? So this is how a Wesselness works. And yeah, you should be able to explain stuff like this. It makes sense, yeah. So you need to show that you got the idea and why this works. If you're a bit sloppy with the math or something, I want to see that you have understood the concept why it works. Because if you understand the concept, then you will also be able to apply the concept to a different problem, and you will be able to develop a blobness measure. Or, yeah, okay? Good. So this was Wesselness. And what did we talk about next? Wesselness. I think we were talking about feature descriptors, right? Yeah. Feature descriptors. SIFT, Harris Corner. Yeah? I mean, these are simple concepts. So scale space, what is a scale space, how do you make a feature descriptor orientation invariant, and so on. So this is also something which you should know. Huh? And then after feature descriptors, we were talking about something else. What came next? Huh? We're getting closer to the today. Structure tensor we already had here. Yeah, but it's related to structure. Super resolution comes here. Edge preserving filtering. You remember bilateral filter where you have a spatially variant kernel. So we did also the normalized convolution where you can make up for missing pixels. Then we did the bilateral filter, which has just a spatially variant filter mask in order to not to smooth over edges. Then we talked about guided filter, which is very efficient, very fast, and it also introduces the concept of the guidance image. And in the end, we looked a bit into the joint bilateral filter, where you also use a guidance image. And for we had the example where we are adding over multiple energy domains of an multiple energy bins of an X-ray image in order to create the guidance image for the joint bilateral filter. And the joint bilateral filter is nothing else than a bilateral filter, but you get the edge information from your guidance image, assuming that it has a lower amount of noise. Exactly. Edge-preserving filtering and then super resolution, where we actually solve a reconstruction problem, where we reconstruct a super-resolved image from a series of input images or from a single input image where we use then prior knowledge or sensor fusion to create the higher resolved image. By the way, these super resolution techniques, there's a very interesting product out there that was issued by one of the device vendors, and they are using, so you can remember maybe PET and CT, these imaging modalities, and typically in PET you have a pretty bad resolution. So you get voxels that are half a centimeter. And in CT, you have voxels that are maybe a millimeter or half a millimeter. And there you can very efficiently apply those single image super resolution approaches, where you try to reconstruct a super resolved image by using essentially the edge information or the frequency information from your CT image, assuming that both are aligned. And then you can get very sharp areas in your PET image. So for example, you can then show that some hotspot is really limited by the bone boundary. And if you have the very bad resolution, it will just be a blob that appears, and then you can enforce it to look more like the bone. But of course, you have to be careful. They also use information from the material, because in bone the likelihood is not as high that the tumor will actually cross the boundary between soft tissue and bone. But if you have organs, the likelihood is higher that there is actually tumor growth. And they also use these physiological features in this reconstruction process. But there's a lot of prior knowledge going in there, and so it is yet to be shown whether you can do more accurate diagnostics from this super resolved image. But this is also a technique where it does something very similar to super resolution, but it's embedded into the reconstruction process. And in fact, the super resolution, if you think back to the iterative analytic reconstruction methods, ART, that we talked about in diagnostic medical image processing, they are very similar. The entire formulation and also the methods, how you solve it, is very similar to ART and iterative reconstruction. So there is a lot of resemblance in this. Okay, super resolution. And that was all about pre-processing we talked about. So we haven't talked about, usually we also talk about the half transform, but I'm skipping this today. So this semester we're not talking about the half transform. Okay, good. And now we will start with a new chapter. And this new chapter is more or less called image analysis. And here we will talk about, so first thing we will introduce is epipolar geometry. And then we will talk about the epipolar geometry is very useful to reconstruct 3D information from two images. And we will also look into factorization. This is I really love this topic, epipolar geometry and factorization. So factorization is generally if you multiply two numbers with each other, or if you have an arbitrary number, you can divide it up into factors. That's factorization. And as you may know, there's an infinite of numbers that you can choose to do certain factorizations. So usually there is not a unique solution to the factorization problem. And we'll find a very neat algorithm that allows us to factorize a matrix and still get a unique solution. So this is then also called structure from motion. And it's very nice. I really like it. Epipolar geometry, and we will talk a bit about segmentation. So we will talk about how to get like boundaries of an organ and something like this. So segmentation is generally the process of finding boundaries of a specific object of interest. So we will look into this. And so this is generally what we want to do in image analysis. And then we will switch to a new topic, which will be non-rigid registration. And if time permits, we will even go to interventional reconstruction, which will be 4D or ND reconstruction. Okay. Good. So this is more or less the overview on our lecture. And now if you get presented with the evaluation sheet, yeah, and then there's the question, did you always have the scope of the lecture in mind? Did you know what the lecture was talking about? This is our red thread, how it's called in the evaluation sheet. No. I'm not doing this because of the evaluation, of course. As you may have noticed, that there is a pretty high likelihood that your first question in the oral exam will be something like, can you present what we talked about in the lecture? Can you give an overview on the lecture? And of course, in the oral exam, you will be expected to be able to explain stuff. Yeah? And you need to not just show that you have memorized all the formula. If you memorize all the formula in our script and on the slides, it may be, I don't think there's a lot of use if you start memorizing formulas in very high detail. So it's not just about knowing formulas, but it's to know how to use them and to know why you need this formula and why there is this quantity in there and why not and why it looks like this. So it's, yeah. Okay, good. Then we can start with today's topic. And today's topic is magnetic navigation. We will first talk a bit about magnetic navigation, and then we will see that for magnetic navigation, what we need is some kind of 3D information, and then we will very elegantly switch to epipolar geometry and talk a bit about the algorithms in epipolar geometry. Okay, so let's talk about our motivation, magnetic navigation. So far we were only doing pre-processing, and if you now have multiple pre-processed images, you can actually obtain more information. From several images, you can get more information, and you can use multiple images to reconstruct a 3D structure, or 3D point locations. And yeah, so in the following, we will talk a bit about processing of multiple images, and in order to make it more easy, multiple will be two for the next few minutes, or for the remainder of this lecture. Multiple image will be two. We will not talk about the relations of three images and things like the free focal tensor, but you can have a look at some computer vision books if you want to know how stuff works if you have three images at the same time. But one thing that you can do is you can break it down to pairs of two images. This should also work. But you can also deal with them at the same time. Okay, so here is magnetic navigation, and let's say you're doing a minimally invasive therapy, and you want to move your catheter, yeah, and you have to go around a very steep corner. So you have to go into the right bifurcation, and then you have this. So this is the imaging system, this is the detector and the source, and then you have this very nice magnet here, and this this magnet can be controlled to do a force into a certain direction. Now, if you have localized the catheter tip, and you have two views of the tip, then you are able to reconstruct the 3D point. And if you know the 3D point, and if you also know the vasculature in 3D, you will be able to derive the direction to pull. And you could do this, for example, with using two X-ray views. So you have two X-ray views, and you have some prior information about the vasculature, how the bifurcation looks like. Then you reconstruct the tip of the catheter, and then you apply the force into the right direction. Yeah? If you only have one view, it may be difficult. Yeah? But if you have the right view, it may already be sufficient. Okay, good. So we will not look into the physics of magnetic navigation. So this is actually, I was leading you into the wrong direction, but we are actually looking into epipolar geometry. So we will use two projections or multiple projections from different viewpoints, and then we want to reconstruct into which direction we have to pull the catheter tip in order to facilitate the surgery. Which brings us to the topic epipolar geometry, and we will start with an image. And unfortunately, here the typesetting went a bit wrong. So the figures in here do so the names in here do not match. They're similar, but they do not match the symbols in the equation in the next slides. But we will explain this anyway, so you will be able to follow. What we have here is two cameras, and the camera has a focal center. This is the camera center 1, this is the camera center 2, and now we have an imaging plane here. So this is our imaging plane, and this is our imaging plane. So we have two cameras, two imaging planes, two focal centers. Now we can connect the focal center on this side and the focal center on this side, which is the translation of the two camera centers. And this translation vector gives us the baseline. So the baseline is the line that contains both camera centers. The connection of the baseline, or the intersection of the baseline with the two imaging planes, is called the epipole. And now this epipole here, this is epipole 1, this is epipole 2, and they are the intersections of the imaging plane with the baseline. Now, in order to reconstruct the 3D point, we need some point in 3D space. And if you have three points, so this is our point of interest. Yeah? This is the world point, W point. And the W point, world point, and the two camera centers, three points in 3D, form a plane. Okay. And now what we will introduce is the fundamental concepts of epipolar geometry. And it basically says that if you have a plane in 3D that is given by the point of interest and the two focal centers, so the focal centers will be fixed for any 3D point, so the epipolar planes that we get is essentially forming a pencil around the baseline. It's a pencil of planes, because all of these planes need to contain a baseline. And now if I select a point in 3D, I'm essentially moving this plane up and down. This has some interesting properties, because if I now project this world point onto camera plane 2 and camera plane 1, I get first of all, I get the projection of the point, and this is what I'm going to measure. So this is what I will be measuring in my camera system. So if I have two cameras and I have a world point, I will be measuring this point P1C and P2C in the camera coordinate system. These are the two points that I'm going to be measuring. measuring. And what I want to reconstruct in the end is the world point here. This is what I want to know. Now, this has a very interesting property because this point, they all lie on the same plane. They lie on the epipolar plane. So the projection of the point must also lie in the epipolar plane. And now we can project the entire epipolar plane onto onto each of the detectors, and we will get what is called the epipolar line. Because the epipolar line, there's two epipolar lines here. There's a line in the left image, and there's a line in the right image. And those epipolar lines belong to the same plane, because they are also element. They are part of the same 3D plane. And this gives us also a very interesting thing. If we know the camera centers, so and if I know this camera center and the rotation, the translation between the two cameras, I can set up a matrix. And with this matrix, I will be able, from any point that I have here, I will be able to compute the, because if I define any point here, I'm automatically defining a plane, because one point and the two camera centers will form a plane. So if I select any point in this projection, I'm defining a plane. And the intersection of this plane with the other camera, with the other image plane, needs to be a line. So what we'll be doing in the following is we want to find efficient ways of, if I select this point here, I will want to efficiently compute the line on this detector that this point must lie in. And this is very useful because if I have multiple interest points and I want to find corresponding points, if I just have two images and they're not calibrated, all points in the other image could be candidates. But if I know the relation of the two cameras to each other, I can use the geometry and narrow down my search space to a line. And then you can find for correspondences between the two cameras just from a line search, because you know they must lie on this line. Otherwise, they won't be belonging to this point in the other image. So this is why epipolar geometry is extremely useful. Yes?
I think this works fairly well for continuous images, but if you discretize, is it still a line?
Well, it's close to the line. Yeah, you also have some numerical inaccuracies in the estimation process anyway, but let's say they will be very close. Yeah? So you have to do some trade-offs, but usually you don't want to have too many of these feature points anyway. So what you probably want to do later is you want to run interest points in the one image, interest points in the other image, and then you can use this to find pairs of potential correspondences. And with the correspondences, you are then able to reconstruct 3D points. So this is what you typically do when you have a feature-based 3D cloud computation. So there are some systems that use two cameras in order to reconstruct 3D point data. And then they're using something like a pattern that they project into the scene that creates nice interest points. And from these interest points, and they're outside the range of the visible light, but can still be seen by the camera, then you are able to reconstruct the 3D point information. So this is how a structured light approach, for example, works. In contrast to a time of light measurement, where you really look into the wave propagation and use the offset between the measured reflection from the signal from the scene and the actual wave that you have emitted into the scene. Okay, so everybody here is now convinced that this epipolar geometry is extremely useful. I consider this as a yes. if you're not convinced, then you probably have to stand up and leave or something. And now it's time to introduce a bit of our variables, of our notation. So we will, you see that this does not very well match this, but you have all heard this now, and now you will be able to match this because I just explained it here in the image, and now I explain the variables again, and This is an advanced course, yeah, so you will be able to do the matching. So two cameras defined by the optical sensor. No, honestly, I have to fix the typesetting of these slides at some point, because then they would pop up as the same symbols. The two cameras and their optical centers will be C1 and C2, that are the two points on the baseline. Then we have some 3D world point that we call WW, because there's not enough double in W. And these are 3D points. And WW is mapped to a point P that is also a 3D point. But it is, so it's a 3D point, but it is in the imaging plane. And this is the, oh no, it's mapped to a 3D point, but it's in the left image. And then there is a point Q that is in the right image. So these are still 3D points before projection to the plane, but they are in camera coordinates. So our camera coordinate is usually aligned with the C axis along the optical axis. So that's the depth. Yeah. So we have the world coordinate system that is somewhere in the world. And then we have the camera coordinate systems, and they are aligned with the viewing direction. And now P and Q are aligned with the viewing direction, but they are still 3D points. So we don't consider any projections so far. We just consider mappings into the different 3D camera coordinate systems. And then there is a translation vector T, which is a translation between the two camera centers. And we have E1 and E2, which are the epipoles, and the epipoles are the intersection of the baseline with the imaging plane. And the epipolar lines are denoted by L1 and L2. These are the intersections with the epipolar plane and the imaging plane, respectively. Good. Now we have the same image again. But what we added here is now this translation and this rotation. So if I want to convert from P to Q, there is a translation and a rotation that I have to do in order to go from one coordinate system into the other one. So it's a rotation and translation. Furthermore, we have F, which is the source detector's distance or the focal length. Then we have PC and QC, which are the points in camera coordinate systems. And they correspond to our world point WW. The observed points can be, the 2D points can be expressed in image coordinates. And we define the origin of the image coordinate system as the upper left corner of the image. So this is now really image coordinates. So P, C, out there, they're still 3D camera coordinates, and P, P, and Q, P are then the 2D points. Okay, and then we have another 2D coordinate system where the origin coincides with the central ray of the projection. So this is a coordinate system where the origin is exactly at the intersection of the imaging plane and the principal ray. And this is then called PI and QI, shown on the next page. Oh, it's not shown. It's shown on the figure in the previous page, not on the next page. Okay. But it's close. It's off by two only. Good. And then we can observe the following relations. And this is pretty much straightforward. That we can express the world point QC and the world point, the 3D point QC and the 3D point PC just by shifting it by T and then rotating. So there's a rotation and a translation that is required in order to transform from QC to PC. And you can rewrite this because this is only a rotation matrix, the transpose is also its inverse. So if you multiply by R transpose from the left, you get R transpose times QC equals PC minus T. Straightforward, okay. And now we use the relation that the points PC PC minus T and T lie on a plane, which means that if T and PC lie on a plane and I do the cross product, I'm getting a vector that is perpendicular, so it's out of plane. It's pointing out of the plane. And now if I do the scalar vector, the scalar product between a vector in this plane and some vector that points out of this plane, I get zero. So this is the information that goes into this equation. So all of these three vectors are in the same plane, and if you do the cross product and then the scalar product of those three vectors, you will get zero. Yeah? They're in the same plane, so this is an out-of-plane vector, and if you have then a vector that is in the original plane, the scalar product needs to be zero. Okay? Good. And what we do now is, well, we have derived this nice relation that PC minus T is R transpose QC, so we can take this one and just plug it into this equation. Yeah? So we take this part and plug it in here, and then we get R transpose QC transpose times the cross product of T and PC. Then we can resolve this transpose here, which will swap the sequence, and the transpose here cancels out, and this one is transposed. And this is quite nice, because now we have a cross product here. And you may remember that a cross product can be rewritten into a matrix multiplication. So you can find a matrix that does a cross product. So this is the skew matrix, you may remember from last semester. And I think we also had it in the refresher. Did we have it? Did we do it in the refresher of the projection models? Maybe not. No, but it's part in last semester. So this is essentially so you can rewrite the vector T into a matrix that has only zeros on the diagonal, and this is the skew matrix, and it will do exactly the cross product. And now you can rearrange it to a matrix multiplication, this guy here, and we denote the skew matrix as those brackets here and the cross at the as index. And these are two matrices, and I can multiply those two matrices. And then I end up with a matrix E. And this is called the essential matrix. And the essential matrix now takes a world point in the left image and a world point from the right camera. And if you have Q transpose times E times PC, it's zero. And what this constraint essentially says us, it's nothing else than a line equation. Yeah. So if I know PC and I multiply it with E, I get the line that belongs to the point in the right image, in the camera of the left image. And if I do the same, if I know QC, I can multiply it with E, and I guess essentially get the line equation to the other correspondence. The line through the optical centers, the line through the optical centers intersects the image planes in the so-called apopods. Okay, we already know that. But this relation is very important here. It's a good suggestion to know how to derive this essential matrix, where the idea is coming from, how these vectors need to be aligned, and it's straightforward then to derive it. So, and this essential matrix is very useful, because then I can take any point in the one camera and find a relation to all the other points in the other camera, and all points that fulfill the constraint multiplied with matrix E equals to zero are on the same plane. So this is what I referred to earlier, that you can get this relation between one point in one image and a line in the other image. And this is expressed by the essential matrix. This is where the skew matrix comes in. So instead of multiplying this cross products, you can set up the skew matrix. And this is defined by a matrix that has zeros on the diagonal, and then you have the components of the vector here and here, and the sign is flipped. So this is your skew matrix. Good. And now that you have the skew matrix, forget about the skew matrix, but now that you have 3D points, The camera points are still 3D points, you remember? But what we can do now is we can project the 3D point onto the image plane. And this is just a matrix multiplication, as we've seen in the projection models. So what we can do is I can take this point here, it's a homogeneous point, and I put in my homogeneous version of the point QC, and I multiply it with our projection matrix, and I get the homogeneous version of QI. So it's just a matrix multiplication. This brings us to the brilliant idea that we could expand our essential matrix with the projection models, because later we will only observe 2D points, right? So let's first, And now we can even extend our essential matrix and put in also our the projection. So we put in the projection from 3D to 2D in homogeneous coordinates, and then we will have this relation here. This is the epipolar constraint. And now we really have homogeneous 2D points in the one image plane and homogeneous points in the other plane, and they are related by this notation. So I essentially plug in my two projection matrices, my two projection operators, into this essential matrix. Okay. Homogeneous coordinates. Yeah. The cross product in homogeneous coordinates, the cross product of two points is a line. And what boils down here? So if you take the essential matrix, transpose the essential matrix, you will realize that R cancels out, and you have only influence of the translational vector in between. And this is also very useful. So if you compute E transpose E, you will get a matrix that is independent of R. And of course, if you plug in a point, it will be mapped onto a line. So we also said that earlier. Also interesting that as a result, the null space of E is spanned by T. This is also interesting. And if you multiply the essential matrix with a constant, it does not change anything because it's invariant up to scale. So you can normalize the matrix either by setting the length of T to 1 or the Frobenius norm of E to 1. So this is a kind of normalization that you can introduce. And the E has 5 degrees of freedom. The rank is 2, so this is very important. Rank of E needs to be 2. And the two non-zero singular values are identical. Good. Now you can also put this into a system of linear equations. So you have your homogeneous version of the one point and the other point. So if you have corresponding points, you can put this into a system of linear equations, and now you have to estimate those 9 unknowns of the essential matrix. So if you want to calibrate an essential matrix, you can decompose it into components, and then you can rewrite it into a single system of equations, and you will realize that the system of equations is linear in the components of E. And now we're doing this trick that we always do. If we want to estimate a matrix, we try to linearize it in the coefficients of the matrix, and then we set up a linear system of equations where the coefficients of the matrix pop up, and then you solve for the coefficients of the matrix. So you can now rewrite E, the matrix E, into a vector E, and E is just the elements of the matrix. And here you only have corresponding points of P and Q. And in this way, you can compute the elements of your matrix here. So this leads us to the Siemens algorithm. So the Siemens algorithm would read point correspondences, then rewrite the epipolar constraints in terms of linear equations, and you have this null space problem, so we can solve it by SVD. So we do the SVD, and we return the last column of V. There we go, we have the epipolar we have the essential matrix. This is how you can implement it. And this thing is called the Siemens algorithm because we are neglecting all of the certain properties that we've seen earlier. But we just compute a brute force version of E and say, okay, this is our solution for E. But now that we know all these properties of E, we can also implement it into the original algorithm, which brings us to the 8-point algorithm. So the 8-point algorithm is now an improved version of the previous algorithm. And this one is also using the point correspondences. And we also rewrite into this linear system of equations. And we also use SVD to estimate our E. So, but we know that that M should not have full rank. Yeah? We know that M needs to be rank deficient. So if we have the last singular value of our SVD, if it is greater than a certain epsilon, we have a full rank matrix, but it should not appear. There should be, M should not be of full rank. And then we can stop, and then we have some problem with our matrix. So we have some problem, either there were outliers or something like that, something's wrong with our data, so we can stop. We won't be able to return a meaningful essential matrix with this. Then we know the null space of M. So because then we need to get the null space. Yeah. So if there's no null space, we cannot just take the last column of V and return it. So then we don't have a meaningful solution for our problem. The only solution would be E, all E equals zero. But we want to create a null space computation, so this is probably not the right solution. If we have a rank deficiency, so we need to have the last sigma to be zero or very close to zero, then we can continue and take the last component here of V and create the essential matrix E. If we only in this condition we are able to determine coefficients of E. And now we do the SVD of E. So we decompose E. We decompose not only the matrix M, but also the matrix E. Because we know the matrix needs to be rank deficient again. It needs to have only two singular values. And if we have a third singular value, if this epsilon is too high, then we stop. Because then, again, we don't have a meaningful E. And this essential matrix would not be meaningful. So it would violate the rank criterion. And what we can do then is we can compare the first and the second singular value. They need to be similar. But if they are far off, if there is a huge difference between the two, we can also stop. Then there's something wrong with our data. We probably have a correspondence problem in there. And we need to check if we have the right correspondence. So then we can stop again because the singular values 1 and 2 they are not similar, so it's probably not a correct essential matrix. And then we can compute an optimized version of E where we really enforce that the two singular values are the same. So we take sigma 1 plus sigma 2 divided by 2 and put it as singular values into our SVD, and then we enforce a matrix that truly has the same singular values. So we're using essentially all the tricks that we can do or a lot of the tricks that we can do with SVD in this 8-point algorithm. And they're all sanity checks. If one of them fails, we probably don't have consistent data. And if you compare it to this one, you wouldn't even notice if you have a correspondence problem there. You would probably just create some matrix E, and you wouldn't even figure out that there's something wrong. But you can tell from the data that it's inconsistent, and you can just then reconsider your correspondences if they're correct or not. And in this case, also Brunsack is a very good option to figure out wrong correspondences. So let us extend this to the fundamental matrix. And now in the fundamental matrix, what we presently had, all the points were aligned with the optical center. And what we now do is we really also consider all the intrinsic parameters of the camera matrix. So in the essential matrix, you consider the extrinsic parameters, rotation, translation, global pose, and also the projection. But in the fundamental matrix, you also consider shifts in the detector in the coordinate system of your camera chip or detector coordinate system. So we extend the concept of the essential matrix to really work on pixel coordinates. Okay, so this is our image that we have for the intrinsic parameters. You know that there might be a skew between the two axes, and then usually you have a shift, so the coordinate system is aligned in the top left and not with the optical center. So these are the additional transforms that you need to do in the intrinsic camera parameters. And you can, okay, so this is the skew. This is all already, so we talked about this in the projection models. You already know this. And what you can now do is you take the camera matrix on the ones, you take the camera matrix of the one matrix and the camera matrix of the other camera, or if they are the same, if they are truly the same cameras, there's only a single K because we assume them to be identical. And then you can plug this into your formalism of the essential matrix, and you multiply it from the left and the right, and what you get is the fundamental matrix. So the fundamental matrix is the concept of the essential matrix expanded really to work on pixel coordinates. But again, remember, you have to go into a homogeneous space. So see, this is a homogeneous space. Okay. So this is all that you do for the fundamental matrix, and then F also has a rank of 2. You can also compute this line, and all epipolar lines must intersect the epipole. This is also something we referred to earlier. And now you can use a very similar algorithm as the 8-point algorithm, or you can adopt the 8-point algorithm to compute F, and you get again n equations of the form where we have two corresponding points and set up that the two multiplied need to be zero. Now we really have somebody who lost interest.
Yeah, we have a meeting later.
So you also leave?
Yeah, 15 minutes.
So I better...
Design something special.
Okay, good. Good, and you can adopt this, but yeah, it's very similar. And we can stand, okay, so if you understand the 8-point algorithm for the essential matrix, you probably also understand the 8-point algorithm for the fundamental matrix. And this is all very similar, so I don't want to go into too much detail here. In fact, there's issues with numerical instabilities and, okay, so let's not discuss all of this in detail. And so you can also compute your intrinsic parameters from your fundamental matrix, but I will skip over this and bring you to the take-home messages that you can reconstruct 3D points and you can find correspondences between two camera views very efficiently, and these epipolar constraints are all very nice, and it's, you can do it numerically robust if you use the 8-point algorithm and the security checks. So this is all nice things. But so far, this set of slides could have been in any computer vision class. Yeah, in computer vision, you do exactly the same. Which is the reason why I stopped with this set of slides here, and I go to a different set of slides here, because I want to show you something where this epipolar stuff is also very interesting for X-ray images. And let us shortly go through here. By the way, this, what I'm showing to you here, is going to be published in TMI Medical Imaging in 1 or 2 months or so. We just have the paper accepted. And this is also the reason I want to keep stuff very recent in this class. So I also want to show you some new results that we have obtained in research and show you that all the things that we talk about in this class are directly related to research that we actually do at the lab. And here we are using essentially a flat panel detector and a camera. They all have this camera matrix stuff, and you can map those concepts back and forth, and calibration is very similar. But there's something different in an X-ray image that you can actually use to drive something which is called data consistency conditions. And data consistency conditions have been around for 25 years. Plenty of work on data consistency, but we found a very nice formalism to relate it to epipolar geometry, which allows us then to use those consistency conditions in any pair of X-ray images. And this is really cool because you can use it on a biplane system, you can use it in a flat panel scan, or so on. Okay, so what's the idea? One reason why we come up with this is motion compensation. So when you do a scan in an interventional system, so those flat panel systems that actually are suitable for all this camera calibration stuff, they typically have an open bore, or not open bore, but they have they're either C-arm systems, or you have them mounted onto a radiation therapy system. They have these flaps where you can use a cone beam system. And in a C-arm system, you have rotation times between 5 to 20 seconds. In a radiation therapy system, which have this heavy radiation treatment device also attached, you have rotation times of 60 seconds and just to acquire a short scan. So only 200 degrees, 60 seconds of rotational range. And you can imagine motion is a huge problem. So if you want to reconstruct images, you have a lot of problem with motion. So in MRI, you can do stuff like particular sequences to estimate the motion. And then use motion compensation algorithms around. And what you typically do is you do some kind of intermediate reconstruction, try to estimate the motion fields, and then reconstruct. And this is all nice, so you get nice results. And we will look into that later, probably in the 4D reconstruction. So we will talk a bit about these results. But so it also works on C-arm systems, so you get improved quality. But you typically need stuff like ECG gating. So you need some kind of prior knowledge about how the motion is done. And so this is, you typically design your motion compensation algorithms for a specific scanner. And sometimes it's the patient moving. So you could have head motion during a stroke treatment. Yeah? So if you're suffering a stroke, you probably involuntarily move your head. And it may also be caused by scanner. So let's say you have an imperfect scanner system that wobbles, and there you also you observe some kind of motion, but it's actually not the object, but it's the scanner that is moving to some degree. And typically, you want to get rid of this. And if you have rigid motion is nice, because rigid motion you can formalize only with a rotation and a translation. So in every view, you want to estimate rotation and translation. And now we can also apply the concept of data consistency metrics. So in CT and X-ray images, there's data consistency. And we'll look a bit into that. But essentially from a CT scan, only from the projection data, you can compute a consistency metric. And it will tell you, it will give you a number. If it's low, it's consistent. And if it's high, it's inconsistent. And there is sources of inconsistency. So it measures inconsistency, but it doesn't tell you what's wrong. So if you get a high number, you can say, oh, there's something wrong. But you don't know, is it motion? Is it scatter? Is it truncation? Is the object bigger than our detector? Any of these causes will be inconsistent. And you can use that. So you can assume motion may be the cause for the inconsistency, and then you can try to estimate the motion in order to get the data more consistent. The great thing is, this is entirely intrinsic. So you don't need any markers or anything. It's only given by the geometry of the system and by essentially the imaging physics. It's purely image-based, no additional sensors. You can compute your data consistency only from the X-ray images. And the next nice thing is you don't have to switch between reconstruction space and projection space. So you can optimize your entire thing only on the projections, and you don't have to compute an expensive reconstruction. So this is very fast. And this is cool, in particular for our interventional scope. We want to have fast methods, and we can apply them only on projection images. Well, it's known to work only for certain applications. One reason why I think it hasn't been pursued in the last couple of years, those data consistency metrics are really cool. But if you think about the geometry, you need some kind of redundancy. And well, we will think about that later. But an X-ray, a CT gantry, typically has a very flat, thin detector. And if you want to find epipolar planes in a detector that looks like this, you probably find only very short planes. Or there's very few long planes that you get between such a long detector. So this is probably one of the reasons why it hasn't been applied in practice so much. But for flat panel, it's really cool. So there's published results from simulations since over 25 years. Some of this in parallel imaging geometry, but all of these concepts have extended to cone beam imaging. But there's very few real data results, and it's never been applied in real system, ever. Okay, let's shortly talk about data consistency. There's two well-known versions of data consistency for parallel beam. One is a projection moments, also called Helgerson-Ludwig conditions, and the other one are sinogram Fourier-based constraint, Natterer and Edholm. So you can see this is from 85 and 86. By the way, there is now a proof that both of them are actually equivalent. They show the same information. In literature, there were already the assumption that they're equivalent, but there has not been a rigorous proof, and we just submitted a manuscript with a proof that they are truly equivalent. Let's see if the reviewer finds a mistake. But I think the proof is quite nice. And then you can extend this to fan beam and cone beam. So this is the moments. And you can now, let's say, there's this SM, and this is the projection. And if you think about this, this is a weighted sum over your projection image. If your weight is uniform, so if you have M equals 0, S will always be 1. Yeah? Something to the power of 0 is always 1. And if you have the zeroth moment, it's just the integral over the entire projection, which says if your object entirely fits onto your detector and you compute the integral over the entire object, the mass of the object doesn't change over the scan, which makes kind of sense. Yeah, if you're imaging an object, the mass doesn't change. It doesn't matter if I'm looking at the object from this side or this side. If I compute the total mass, it's the same. And then there's higher order moments, but let's not think about them right now. Let's stay with the zeroth moment. And you can do a Fourier expansion, and this then yields us the constraint that it needs to be 0. Now, total mass is identical in all projections. We talked about this. And there is the sinogram Fourier space constraints. And they now say there need to be triangles. So you take the sinogram and you do a FFT of the sinogram. So usually you do an inverse Radon transform and you reconstruct. But if you do a 2D FFT of your sinogram, you get an image that looks like this. Hopefully it looks like this. Or ideally it looks like this. And you see those areas here, those triangles, they are 0. And in fact, you can prove that they need to be 0. And so you do the 2D FFT. This is a consistent sinogram, and you get nice 0 areas. And this is a motion-corrupted sinogram. And here you can see that in this green triangle, there is mass, and there is no mass supposed to be there. Yeah? This is what consistency conditions allow you to do. And then you can do a motion compensation by requiring the mass to disappear by motion from those triangles. So this is something you can do. Now, this is all very interesting, and but the bad thing is, you require for the higher order moments, you require the entire scan. If you want to do a motion compensation or compensation like this, you need to have the entire scan available. But if you now only have pairs of projection images, you can't do the sinogram Fourier space constraints. Okay. Then let's think a bit about the Radon transform. So we heard about the Radon transform last semester, but maybe we forgot about it, what it was. Let's do a short refresher. So the Radon transform, what it does is it takes, so this is the 2D case, it takes the integral of an object and places it into your detector array. And everything is parallel. Now I rotate my gantry around the object and I get the 2D Radon transform. Yeah? So I have a parallel imaging device and I sum over all the rays, I rotate, and this is my Radon transform. It's essentially a parallel beam CT acquisition. And this gives us the sinogram. Now, in 2D, the X-ray transform, X-ray accumulates an integral over a line. So this is called the X-ray transform. The Radon transform, in fact, accumulates over an integral that is one dimension lower than the actual image domain. So in 2D, the Radon transform is a 1D integral. In 3D, this is not the case. So in 3D, if you had a parallel detector and a parallel source array, the 3D X-ray transform will accumulate the mass along this ray here. So this is the X-ray transform because it's a line and the integral over the line. So this is what the X-ray does. But what the Radon transform does, it is projecting onto 2D integrals. So it's plane integrals. So if you want to compute truly radon data from this kind of detector, you would have to draw a line on your detector and accumulate everything on this line, and then you have a value in the radon transform. Now line on detector, planes in 3D, yeah? So this is the integral over this plane is a result, is a value in the radon transform, and you can do this for multiple planes, and you end up with values in the radon transform. So this is the Radon transform, 3D Radon transform. And now if you want to compute a value of the Radon transform, you take a line and you accumulate and you get different values in the Radon transform. Okay, so this is the nice thing is now if you want to create values from the 3D Radon transform, you take the projection image and you apply a 2D Radon transform to it. Because there you project lines onto line integrals. So you have a 2D projection, you apply a 2D Radon transform, and you get values from your 3D Radon transform. Interesting. Okay, good. So let's continue. Epipolar geometry, now we have a scan. So we have multiple pairs here, and we don't know where X is. And now we have a second view, and we can suddenly resolve X. Then, of course, we have this effect if we... So this is the pencil of planes. Yeah, this is the pencil of planes. If I move X, you get this effect with your epipolar planes. Okay? Good. All of this is clear, so we can jump around this. And now we can think about redundancy on epipolar lines because those two epipolar lines in the projection view, they are the same plane, which essentially says that the integral along this line in projection 1 and the integral along the same line, the same plane in projection 2, they are the same. So any pair of epipolar lines that match should have the same integral. And suddenly I can find thousands of consistency conditions between two projections. And I can use those consistencies in order to optimize my geometry and other things. So this is very nice. So the integrals are the same and I can use this consistency. One thing that we unfortunately have is this is not true for fanbeam geometry. As long as everything is parallel, everything is nice. So we can say, okay, this is nice. We have the same parallel integral, and the same integral comes out for every view. But it's not true for fanbeam, because your fan has this divergence. And if you integrate along a divergent bundle of rays, you get a different integral from this view or from this view. So we need to do something to fix it. And luckily, there's Grandjean's theorem, and this is also well known in reconstruction. So you can apply this, and the trick now is that this essentially is a weighted integral. And now this weighting here, it can be cancelled out if you take a derivative with respect to the normal of the plane. So if you compute the normal of the plane and you derive your radon data, so your line integral data, so the integral over the planes, and you derive with respect to the normal of the planes, then you can get rid of this weighting. And now the trick is that you compute the two neighboring lines, two neighboring planes essentially, and you compute the derivative with respect to the normal. And this derivative now reduces, or not reduces, but it kicks out the weighting that is applied by the fan. And now the derivative between this is the same in another view. So this is then rotation invariant. This trick is known as Grandjean's trick. And you can now also define this consistency in any pair of X-ray projection images. So let's look at an example. So this is now the derivative of the line integrals along those epipolar lines. So in green you see the epipolar lines, in yellow you see highlighted one epipolar line that is the same, and in blue you see epipolar lines here. Now you integrate along those epipolar lines and you compute the derivative. And here you can see the function of this derivative in the one view and the other view, and although they are taken from two different angles, they show the same function. And now if you have a shift in between the two, you can just correct for this shift and align them in a way that they are optimally aligned. Okay, then you can start thinking about stuff. So for example, if you have a constellation like this one here and you shift your object along the V direction, so up and down, you get a lot of signal change. So translation in V will cause a lot of change because you will introduce consistency. But if you translate in U, nothing happens because U is the direction you're integrating over. And if you're integrating in that direction, you won't see any changes in U. So particular views, the orientation of two views, are more or less useful to detect certain shifts. So if you have two views that are very close to each other, you can very efficiently, because of the epipolar geometry, you can very efficiently detect a shift in V. But if you have two views that are approximately, if you have two opposing views, by the way, then you have the baseline running across the two, and then all your epipolar planes are around this baseline. So I think I have a couple of examples here. And this is how you can compute it. Let's skip over this a bit. This is not so super interesting, but this is interesting. So if you have two views that are almost from the same orientation, so there's a low angle between the two views, the epipolar lines will form more or less a parallel system. You get very parallel epipolar lines. So you can efficiently detect motion in V direction. Now if you start rotating the one view, you will see that the angle will get steeper. And if you continue until you have opposing views, then you will have a system where you can very efficiently detect motion in U and V direction. So those two views would be very good for detecting motion in U and V direction, but you would never realize a motion that is exactly along the baseline. So if the motion is aligned with the baseline, then you won't be able to see that because it doesn't influence the integrals, or not very much. So this kind of constellation is not very efficient for Z, and if you want to have the depth correctly aligned, you probably need a configuration like this one. So you need a pretty large baseline in order to do that. Okay. Yeah, so we can summarize this. And this is the representation in radon space, but let's not consider this too much. But now we only, by epipolar geometry, we can now think about which kind of motion which we can correct with what kind of X-ray pairs, how they need to be aligned, and we can figure out the robustness in one or another direction only from epipolar geometry, and why we could compensate in this direction better. Yeah. And in radon space, by the way, the epipoles move on the line. Okay, conclusion. We have here a new formulation for a consistency metric, and I hope you could follow, because I'm totally excited about this. I like this a lot, because we have a relation between radon transforms and epipolar constraints, and that essentially the integral over the plane needs to be the same, and because we have the same epipolar plane in all of the views, the integration needs to be the same. But again, we have to compute a derivative because of the fan, but this is really a very useful tool. And this will work on any pair of transmission images. Yeah. So you could do this on any pair of transmission images. So, This slide was written by Andre, so he's referring. Very important that we have the elegant notation from computer vision here, but heavily embedded into reconstruction theory. Okay, good. Any questions so far? Did you like this? I like it a lot. Okay. So if there's no questions, then we meet. So next Tuesday, so we will have a lecture next Tuesday, right? No, there's no lecture because of back cafe? Is there a lecture or not? No lectures on Tuesday? On Thursday? Yes. Yeah, Erlangen is pretty crazy around this time of the year. You could tell me, no, we can't do Thursday. This. We can be thirsty on Thursday. Okay, so then see you next week, Thursday. Okay?